Today on Against the Grain, these are anxious times for all of us, but even more so for those whose labor is deemed essential during a pandemic. Delivery drivers, grocery workers, those working in Amazon warehouses, and of course, healthcare workers. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with organizer and writer Chris Brooks about the challenge for labor under these unprecedented circumstances and how we can still organize our collective strength. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In Pittsburgh, sanitation workers refused to pick up trash and set up blockades with their trucks at the sanitation headquarters until they were given protective gear. In New York City, teachers forced Mayor de Blasio to shut schools down with the threat of a massive sick out. In Detroit, bus drivers forced the city to make the buses free for patrons so they could enter the backs of the bus and not come in contact with the drivers. And auto workers have walked off the job to demand safe working conditions. These are just a number of the actions that workers have taken since the spread of COVID-19. And to discuss some of them, I'm joined from New York City by Chris Brooks. He's a former union organizer and writes for Labor Notes, which has been tracking worker struggles during the pandemic. Chris, before we get into the details of what's been going on for workers in the United States since the coronavirus came on the scene, how would you characterize the state of workers before COVID-19?
Well, not good. We live in a time of gross income inequality, wealth inequality, rising corporate power. Union density continues to diminish year after year, both in the private and public sector. So there has been a concerted, organized effort by the business community, by employers, to diminish working class power, and it's been successful. It's been, going on since the 70s. So what we're seeing right now is at a time of gross inequality, we have labor candidates coming forward like Bernie Sanders promoting policies that really represent working class interests. But unfortunately, there's not a real labor movement behind him. There are silver linings and shining stars in the labor movement. The St. Paul teachers who are out on strike when COVID happened, the Chicago teachers, Los Angeles teachers, lots of teachers organizing. There's lots of great nurse organizing. But on the whole, we're not seeing a broad, deep working class base, the kind of broad, deep labor movement that would be necessary to really advance those kinds of policies. So now when this strikes, it's at a very scary moment because the real voices that are in the room in the White House in most of the halls of power are going to be those of the business community. It's going to be the employers' interests who are really put forward first and primarily.
Noting what you've said about the lack of a widespread labor movement, we also have seen before the onset of COVID-19 an increase in strikes in 2018-2019 marked a 35-year high for the number of workers involved in major work stoppages over a two-year period. What role did relatively low unemployment have, do you think, on that strike activity? That is, people feeling like if they strike and they're fired for striking, they have the possibility of finding another job.
I think that that's definitely played a role in some of the strikes that we've seen, specifically in thinking about the Stop and Shop strike that happened in New England. I mean, it was really impressive. This was not a strike that I think the UFCW necessarily laid the groundwork for, like in years and years in advance or anything like that. But workers had the sense of like, well, this is a really crappy job and I could just go across the street and get another crappy job. So I might as well go out on strike. So I think that definitely played a role, but there are unions that have been building towards more significant strikes, specifically within teachers and like the Unite Here, the hotel worker strikes that were coordinated across the country that really were able to make some really significant advances that also signal the fact that there are unions that are thinking about the strike as an economic weapon to use in negotiating that they haven't in a way in the past, right? That there's an economic thing that's happening, right? But it's also a political moment that we're in where more and more people recognize the public is in support of them. I think that's definitely true with teachers. Most teachers aren't going to move out of state to go teach somewhere else. But teachers in West Virginia were just so fed up. They were so tired. Teachers in Oklahoma, teachers in Louisville, Kentucky, teachers in Arizona, right? We're recognizing the fact that we're so fed up. We've seen such a diminishment in our working conditions. And what we learned is that when workers step out and make big and bold demands in this current crisis that we've been in for the last few years, you know, in terms of economics, people were supporting them. So, you know, so I think it's a combination of all those things that have created an opportunity where there wasn't, say, in the 90s, right, for workers to really organize and stand up and fight for their interests.
And yet, of course, what we're seeing right now is an utter change to all of those conditions, because we're going from relatively low unemployment to, you know, really rocketing unemployment. And at the same time, the challenge is that when we historically have organized collectively as workers, we've come together physically. And now everyone has to stay at home if we're not deemed essential workers. How does this affect the dynamic of workers standing up for what they need at a moment like this?
There's really no historical analogy for the moment that we're in. I mean, you know, and 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, unemployment was at like 282,000 cases in the United States, and now it's shot up to 3.3 million. It's just astronomical. You know, at the height of the Great Depression, the number of people that were unemployed in the United States at its top was 25%, and we're seeing projections that it could go as high as 30 in the very, very near future. So the economic crunch that is coming at us full tilt is very real. It's very scary. And at the moment when we need workers to be organizing to be able to make sure that their interests are attended to, we're in a pandemic where people can't physically come together or shouldn't physically come together because it risks spreading this disease. I don't think you can point to anything like this in the history of the United States and say that, you know, we can learn lessons from it. So I think it really speaks to the need for us to exert influence, especially on politicians. You know, we already see right-wing politicians like former U.S. Senator Bob Corker coming out and saying, you know, the real priority should be on getting people back to work. You know, you've seen it with Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick came out and said that, you know, the elderly should be willing to sacrifice their lives for the economy. Donald Trump is echoing this, you know, the denier in chief about, you know, the extent and scope of the pandemic and really the potential loss of millions of lives. And saying that, you know, we should prioritize the health of the Dow over the health of actual human beings. So, you know, this is a really scary time for a lot of people. There are a lot of different things, you know, challenges that people are balancing in their heads. You know, a lot of precarious workers out there are saying, well, you know, if this thing peaks in 4 to 5 weeks, I need to get as many hours in now because I don't have much of a savings to fall back on. What does it mean if I lose my health insurance and I get sick right now? You know, so there's a lot of economic uncertainty that unfortunately is going to drive people to probably engage in social interactions that they otherwise wouldn't, right? They would rather be home protecting their family, taking care of themselves and staying safe, but instead they have to go and work in the grocery store. Instead they have to go and deliver, you know, pizzas. So, you know, this is a really scary moment that I think workers are going to have to be creative and think about, you know, how to organize and how to not only protect themselves right in this moment, but also think about what does it mean for us to have a vision for a different kind of society where we're not forced to have to go to work, where we don't have unemployment insurance, you know, where the welfare state has been eroded to such a degree that people are stuck in this predicament.
Well, one tactic, and as you say, this is an unprecedented moment, and it's really hard to draw on lessons from other times. But one tactic that has been used successfully by workers has been the refusal to work. And one example of that was teachers in New York City, where you are based, having a sick out when the city refused to shut public schools down. Tell us about that.
That's such an inspirational example. So that was actually organized by MORE, or the Movement of Rank and File Educators, which is the Social Justice Caucus of the United Federation of Teachers, which is the union local here. It's the largest union local in the United States. And, you know, these are a group of like what we like to call the troublemaking wing of the labor movement. Like they're the rabble rousing, organizing, militant grouping within the union who said, you know, de Blasio is not taking this serious enough. We have cases of students and teachers coming to work sick, spreading the disease. You know, New York City has the largest school system in the country, and the disease could spread very easily, not just through the schools, but then back into the homes of the people who are coming to the schools. And those conditions are conducive to the pandemic spreading at a much more rapid pace than it would otherwise. And the only responsible action to take is to cancel school and then to think through, you know, what a plan would look like to make sure that those students have access to the food that they might otherwise be receiving at schools, right? What are the support systems that are there in the school systems? You know, because unfortunately, given the fact that we live in a time of such great inequality, all of these additional responsibilities, like having counselors, having access to a nurse, having access to food, are placed on the school system, and teachers rightfully take that very seriously. So they organized a sick out. They put pressure on de Blasio to say, you absolutely have to cancel schools. The governor, Cuomo, also put pressure on de Blasio. And then they ended up doing the right thing and then began thinking through the questions about how to make sure that people's needs were met in the interim. And I think we've seen a lot of that. We've seen people really stepping forward and recognizing, you know, we can't allow these employers to continue to act like business as usual, like this is a normal moment we're in, that things can just continue as they were, because we see what's happening in Italy, we see what's happening in China, we see what's happening in Spain, and we don't want that to happen here. We've got to flatten the curve. We've got to do everything we can to keep people from interacting with each other socially, so that way the disease won't spread.
One place where we've seen the refusal of work is with auto workers taking action, often against the wishes of their own union. Can you tell us about the wildcat strikes that have been taking place?
Yeah. I mean, you know, because union density is so low across the country, we're actually seeing, you know, workers walking off the job everywhere, whether they're unionized or not. And in many places where there is a union, sometimes that union has become much more oriented towards a labor management cooperation, or much more oriented towards working with the employers rather than seeing their interests as inherently different. And I think the UAW is definitely within that camp. Unfortunately, the UAW officialdom, you know, has been undergoing this massive corruption scandal, right, where many of the top officials have been indicted or pled guilty to taking direct payouts from employers or stealing from their own membership. So the UAW, once one of the most progressive and militant and important unions in the country, has really withered. But auto workers are still a huge workforce. They show up to these massive plants. They produce, you know, what I think of as the most iconoclastic American product, you know, the automobile. And oftentimes, you know, in these auto plants, they're working 3,000 to 5,000 people very close to one another. It's a very dirty environment, and they're all touching the same thing, the car, as it passes down the line. You know, a car starts at one end of the shop as a frame and literally ends up with, you know, an engine and four tires and drives out to the course at the other. And so that entire time, the process, you know, where they're producing, you know, 600 to 800 vehicles a day, everybody's touching the same surfaces. There's not time broken in for people to wash their hands or for there to be real disinfection. And so if somebody comes into that plant, you know, with the coronavirus, it's and they may be asymptomatic. You know, they're saying it could take 3 to 5 days before anybody even shows symptoms. They could easily spread it to many other people. We've seen that in these plants, people that come in with the disease are infecting other people, and it spreads very rapidly. We've even had the cases of auto workers dying in Michigan as a result of this. And the auto companies have just not taken it seriously. You know, they're saying like, well, we'll clean the plant at night. You know, if somebody gets sick, well, we'll cancel work for a shift maybe, and then have everybody come back in and we'll claim to have disinfected everything. And unfortunately, the UAW has gone along with that. They've not been publicly pushing the auto companies to cancel. You know, these auto companies, after being bailed out numerous times, have done very well in the last few years. They're cash rich. They can easily withstand, you know, according to Wall Street analysts, they say that they could easily withstand shutting down for months. So, you know, the UAW, rather than taking the position that it's in the best interest of the public, it's in the best interest of employees for the auto companies to shut down, they've just been going along with it. And so in response to that, the auto workers themselves have been organizing on the shop floor. We've heard cases in plants where auto workers have come in and just stood there, and they've let the cars go by and they've refused to work on them. There's been cases where workers, after hearing that one of their colleagues was walked out of the plant with symptoms, just walked off the job to shut down production. And they've really forced the conversation on the employers. I don't think the employers would have shut down. You know, they announced a shutdown for the end of the month. They're now saying people need to go back in April, you know, which is the time basically along the timeline that Trump is floating right now for people to be back at work by Easter. And a lot of the UAW membership is rightfully scared and angry right now. And unfortunately, they're not seeing the UAW leadership step up to this challenge. So I think it really speaks to the moment that we're in, that a lot of the responses that we're seeing and challenging employers in this mandate they have, the production has to continue, is coming from the grassroots. It's coming from rank and file auto workers and other workers who are organizing together to say, you know what, enough is enough. Our lives matter more than your profits.
Right. And it also raises the question of why certain industries manage to not be shut down. One can certainly understand healthcare, but auto production, why is that an essential service?
That's a great question. You know, the Department of Homeland Security has put out, and several other federal agencies have put up their own guidelines about what they see as essential services, and they are incredibly broad. And it seems evident from, you know, me and other people who look at this, that the employers were in the room, you know, talking and lobbying with federal agencies to try to make sure that they were included. So they came up with just these incredibly expansive and inclusive definitions of what constitutes an essential industry. And just to give you an example of how ludicrous it is, you know, GameStop, which is just a small, you know, retail chain that that sells pre-owned video games, was claiming that, you know, under the guidelines put out by the federal government, it constitutes an essential industry and therefore was mandating that its employees come to work. It's just totally ridiculous. So, you know, it's not just the auto industry, it's many other businesses that are doing this because, you know, they're saying, well, our profits matter more than the lives of our, you know, our employees or the community. I mean, it's really shameful. There's absolutely no justification for the auto plants to stay open. The only possible justification is for them to retool the plants and reconfigure them so that way they could produce the necessary medical supplies that we need in this moment, which there has been some movement towards. But as of right now, the auto companies are literally talking about just opening up for auto production itself in April, which is just, I'm, you know, as you can tell, like I'm at a loss for words for it, you know, like at a time when health experts are saying that we need to have a lockdown in this country for, you know, 3 to 5 weeks, the auto companies want to open back up. It's just ludicrous.
I'm speaking with organizer and writer Chris Brooks. He writes for Labor Notes. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and we're talking about labor action in a time of coronavirus. Speaking of essential services, undoubtedly the delivery of food is an essential service, and grocery stores are one of the few places open. How has that sector, that is supermarkets, grocery stores, been reorganized in recent years, and how does that contribute to the dangers that the workers are facing right now?
So, like many industries, including healthcare, the grocery industry has adopted the Toyota model of lean production. And what that means is that they try to increase their profits by reducing labor costs to the greatest degree possible. They run their stores on skeleton crews, the smallest number of workers who are almost all, you know, employed part-time, so that way they can't, you know, receive health insurance or other benefits. And then they use just-in-time production. So under this process, they don't warehouse goods in large numbers anymore, but they only produce goods on the basis of how many they think are likely to sell in the store. So rather than, you know, you think back like 50, 60 years where a producer produces, toilet paper, and then the toilet paper fills up in the warehouse. And then whenever the store needs it, they contact the warehouse and it sends it over. Instead of that, they get rid of the warehouses and it goes directly from the producer to the stores. And the stores try to adjust the amount that they're asking for and the producer is producing based on what they see as the demand is being, you know, based on the past. And that might sound great in theory, right, as a cost saving measure. But what it does is it means that whenever there's a massive increase in the number of products, that system isn't capable of producing it because there isn't a backlog anywhere of toilet paper to exist. So this is what we're seeing happen in these stores, is you're seeing all of a sudden this just-in-time lean production model totally breaking down. I mean, it was hard enough for workers as it was because they were stretched really thin to work very quickly to get the jobs done with a small number of staff. Now they're having to do all of this and meet all these needs that are out there when there's just a total diminishment of supply. Unfortunately, you know, grocery stores have not treated grocery workers historically as being essential employees, which is what they're being called today. I mean, if you were to tell a grocery worker a month ago that they were an essential industry, I don't think a single one of them would have said that they felt like anybody else agreed with you when you were making that statement. But now they're rightfully being, you know, recognized, you know, for the how important their labor actually is. But they're going to work in these incredibly dangerous environments. Most grocery chains are not taking this crisis seriously like they should be. So they're not, you know, creating limits on the number of people that could enter a store. They're not mandating 6 feet apart on the checkout lines. They're not setting limits on the number of products an individual can buy, so that way they can't just clean out the house. They're not providing protective equipment to the employees that are there. They've really created the conditions in which this virus could spread very easily and very quickly through the grocery stores, and everybody has to go to the store to get their food. So, you know, this is it really is an essential industry. It's an essential occupation. It's an essential work site, and it's an essential site for consumers. And so we really need those to be as safe as possible. But unfortunately, when you make all of those standards voluntary, when you say that no employer has to abide by them, you know, by mandate, then it's left up to the workers to organize to force their boss to do it. And that's very difficult to do.
What about this question of hazard pay? Are workers being compensated for the risks they're taking? Because undoubtedly, if you're a grocery worker, not only you, but potentially your family is much more exposed to the danger of contracting COVID-19.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so some grocery workers, thankfully, are unionized with the United Food and Commercial Workers, or UFCW, and they have been capable of winning hazard pay in some of the large, retail grocery chains in the country. You know, so Safeway employees right now are receiving a $2 an hour premium on their pay. Giant has given workers a 10% pay increase. Shoppers is giving them $2 an hour more, plus double time for their overtime and on Sundays, which is great. But unfortunately, there are some like Kroger, which just gave their employees a $300 one-time benefit if they, you know, a bonus if they were full-time and $150 bonus if they were part-time, which is really, you know, adding insult to injury. They're saying you have to show up to work. You're an essential industry. We recognize how essential you are, but then we're going to give you a pittance, you know, in reflection of that. And Kroger's also been very bad in terms of not doing any of these safety precautions. So speaking to workers there, you know, they have a long laundry list of ideas about how to make their job much more safer, both for themselves and for the community. But Kroger, as a company, has not been interested in implementing any of those safety precautions.
And then what about if workers want to, rather than get hazard pay, I mean, if they're lucky enough to get it, opt out of working there for the time being? Is that an option anywhere, or is that just a formula for losing your job?
Well, I mean, I would advocate for, you know, workers to engage in concerted activity as much as possible to protect themselves and their family. You know, the National Labor Relations Act, a federal law for private sector employees, allows for them to come together and to make demands on their employer and to walk off the job and in pursuit of those demands. I would strongly encourage workers to use every, you know, legal vehicle available to them in order to win their demands. And so, you know, hopefully we'll, you know, we're already seeing a lot of this bubbling up everywhere where workers are beginning to take action. You know, we saw this, the Detroit bus drivers. I mean, just an incredible story there where they were very concerned. All of these people coming into the front of the bus, having to pay, you know, in the slot there, putting them in direct contact with the bus driver. If the bus driver gets sick, they're then going to spread it to all of those people. They're all breathing in the same space. So they went on strike and said, no, buses should be free right now. We'll have everybody come in and out of the back doors to keep the drivers safe. And as much as possible, we're encouraging people, you know, if you don't have to take the bus, to not do it, to protect everybody on it. But if you do have to take it, then to recognize that it's going to be a free service in this moment of crisis, and that you have to work with us to try to make sure that everybody is safe that's on it. So there we see such a great example of how workers taking, you know, strike action forced, their employer to meet their demands. So we need to see a lot more of that right now. You know, it's not obviously under the Trump administration, the federal government is not going to be putting pressure on employers in the way they should to act responsibly. So it's going to be entirely up to the working class to organize itself to force it to happen.
Well, you just mentioned drivers, and obviously with people shut in at home and often ordering things, essential goods or food, you have a whole lot of burden placed on delivery workers. Now, some of them are unionized, like the UPS workers. Some of them are not. What sort of situation have those workers been finding themselves in across the country?
Yeah, I mean, it's bleak out there, right, for everybody. I mean, both the postal workers and UPS drivers are unionized with the Teamsters. And, you know, there's several different unions in the post office. But the employers, again, like, just aren't taking this seriously. You know, we're hearing all these horror stories about workers having to, like, find their own personal protective equipment if they can have it. Sometimes employers don't even want them to have it. Not taking the precautions that would be needed, you know, saying that things might be delivered more slowly at this point in time because, you know, there's a lot of safety precautions that need to be put into place. I think especially, you know, about postal workers, you know, we found that this virus can live on surfaces and it's possible for it to be transmitted through packages and things like that, and, you know, surfaces that people are touching and sharing with one another. So it's really, really important that they be provided you know, with hand sanitizer, with gloves, with, you know, with masks to protect themselves. These are legitimate essential services, but the employers are not taking the action that's necessary. So again, these workers are having to organize to draw attention to it. They're having to try to get the media involved. And, you know, one of the tricky things right now is, like, you know, you used to be able to just throw up a picket line and all be together, you know, and try to get attention and not have workers cross it. That's not really what's going to happen right now. So we're seeing some sort of creative actions that are taking place. People, for example, are organizing to get in their cars and to create blockades to employers to keep people from having to go into a certain location, or just circling around an area and honking their horns and getting the media to come out to try to raise attention. You know, so there's a lot of things that people are exploring in right now, to, you know, with this question of, like, how do we mobilize, how do we use collective action and stay safe at the same time? It's a challenge.
I've heard both anecdotally and otherwise about postal workers being pressured to work when they're sick. And in fact, one hears those stories all the way across the various essential industries, grocery workers and so on. What can workers do in that situation? What would you recommend people do?
They absolutely should not go to work if they're sick. I mean, that's clear, right? You know, unfortunately, we live in a country, even though it's the wealthiest country in the world, there's no mandated sick leave policy, you know, federally across the government. So it's different state by state, it's different employer by employer, if you have a union contract or not. But, you know, I mean, unfortunately, with this virus, what we know is that even, you know, by the time you're showing symptoms, you were already sick for a few days, and you were probably already spreading that virus to other people. So it's totally grossly insufficient for us to say that people should even just start staying home, or you can only get paid sick leave if you're sick. If there's any chance at all that you've been exposed to this virus, you have to be quarantined. You know, that's just a fact. And we're not taking even that level of precaution. You know, the fact that people would just have to wait till they actually exhibit symptoms is incredibly irresponsible for the employers to be putting people into that position. So, you know, health and safety, I mean, the way that I think about this, and in a lot of ways, this is one of the most dire occupational health and safety disasters to strike the United States. You think of things like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, you know, in New York City. You know, that there was, you know, this massive rallying around and organizing around after it happened. This is like that. This is a moment where we're recognizing that people's working conditions have direct impacts on their health and safety, but also the health and safety of everybody in the community. And in those essential services where people are providing a service that literally is public facing, you know, you think about, like, everybody has to have their mail delivered. You know, there's a lot of important things that are happening. Those workers need to be protected because that protects us. You know, so everybody should be organizing around this. Everybody should be concerned about this. They should be contacting their state legislators. They should be contacting their governor. They should be contacting the federal government, their Congress people, and demanding that these workers be protected and provided, you know, the economic safety that they need in order to be able to do their job and then take the time off if they're sick.
Well, of course, some of the only places that are hiring are, as we talked about earlier, the grocery industry, but also Amazon. And if I understand correctly, Amazon's policy is that people can't take time off unless they actually have COVID-19, and then they get 2 weeks.
Yeah. It's really incredible. There's been a group of Amazonians United is what they're called. They're not a union. They're just a group of non-union but organized workers within these Amazon warehouses that have come together to demand paid time off, that they can be able to use it. And it really took a series of concerted actions and a lot of publicity for the, you know, the world's richest company run by the world's richest man to provide them, you know, this just most bare bones, benefit that they really need. So there's a lot of issues that go on at an Amazon plant. You know, you think about, like, all of the people that are having items delivered to them right now, so that way they don't have to go out in public. Or you think about all the grocery stores that are having so much product move through them right now. That's putting in an incredible strain on the bodies of the people that are there, right? They're having to physically lift and move all of these products, often in very unsafe environments, often in environments with very lax safety precautions. And so their bodies are getting a real physical toll put on them. And then on top of that, it makes them more susceptible to a potential virus. So, you know, these workers are really on the front lines. They're really putting, they're really doing a service for all of us, even in Amazon. And it's just incredible that this company is not, you know, willing to provide them these just most basic benefits.
It's actually one of the ironies of the moment that one of the companies that has been most known for being incredibly hostile to workers' rights, to union activity, expands in a moment like this. So the challenges that existed for those workers before this moment have I guess, expanded as well. Although, would you say that their social power has also expanded in some sense?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that, you know, I think your insight could be expanded to this country. I mean, like, the United States government is incredibly hostile to workers because it's largely run and operated on the behalf of corporate interests, right? Corporate power has been on the rise. And in a moment of crisis, corporate power has been very good at extending its interests. You know, you think about after Hurricane Katrina with what happened in New Orleans, you think about all of these opportunities when a crisis comes along and they're the ones with the armies of lobbyists and with all of that, you know, the fundraisers that they've thrown for the politicians to be able to enact their program. So really what it's going to take in this moment is for workers to recognize that we have a lot of power when we act together, that it's absolutely essential that we have a culture of solidarity. You know, I look at like what happened to England after World War II. You know, if you look at the United Kingdom, they created a massive welfare state. You know, the creation of the National Health Services and these other things came out of this idea of like, we have a culture of solidarity. We have to take care of one another. The only way to avert future crises is by relating to one another and recognizing that you know, my interests are tied in with your interests. And I think that this pandemic creates that opportunity in that moment, right? Like we can recognize that we're all bound up together in this life and that we can make it better for all of us. But there are people who are standing in the way of that have a political agenda that is antithetical to the social good. And it's up to us to organize to defeat them.
And as you say, crises often lend themselves to the interests of the wealthy and the powerful to become even more wealthy and powerful. But it is interesting also to note that after the Spanish influenza of 1918-1919, which really ravaged the globe, also followed World War One, of course, but that in the 1920s, a number of countries affected by the pandemic then adopted universal health care. Today, we're discussing the state of workers in a time of the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm joined by former union organizer Chris Brooks. He is a writer for Labor Notes. And I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, in talking about workers around the country, obviously the kind of changes that have taken place to the way capitalism is organized in the United States over the last 40 or so years has led to more and more precarious workers who are freelancers or gig workers. Can you tell us about the situation they find themselves in and if any of them cross over into these essential workers categories?
Yeah, it's definitely the case that we've seen the rise of these major employers like Uber that definitively operate as if their drivers are employees, but yet want to claim that they are not because it allows them to skip out of having to pay any sort of taxes or benefits or be, you know, socially responsible for their well-being. That's created a huge crisis for many people who are relying on that industry for their income. And what we've seen is just a really incredible example of worker organizing to force these employees to correctly classify them as employees. So I think of AB5, the legislation that was just passed in California, which created a very simple way to determine whether or not someone is an employee. And under that legislation, Uber and Lyft drivers are. And so they have to be provided unemployment insurance. They have to be provided Social Security. They have to be given health benefits if they work over a certain number of hours. So that has really been a game changer. And I think it's really had a tremendous impact on the Uber's, you know, future, which Uber's, you know, like a Wall Street darling, right, that everybody's investing in, and their entire business model is based around misclassification. So in places like California, these workers are very protected. But then in states all across the country where they don't have that kind of legislative protection, Uber has gotten away with not doing any of that. And they're now in a place where, you know, if nobody's taking Uber, then they're just, you know, tough luck. They're out there, they're not making any money, and they can't even file for unemployment. So that's a very dangerous situation. The current legislation that Congress is looking at possibly passing, this $2 trillion package, while grossly insufficient in many ways, one of the things it does do is hopefully, fortunately, it would give them access to some unemployment insurance, which I think for many people, they're in a desperate place and they would really need it. But unfortunately, what has to happen in the future is that we need rather, you know, our fractured, broken labor law system to be corrected, our employment law system to be corrected, and for these companies that have really built a business model out of misclassification of workers to be held accountable, and for these workers to be correctly classified as employees.
Well, let's talk about healthcare workers who are clearly absolutely on the front lines right now in a woefully inadequate situation, some which is the responsibility of employers, some which is the responsibility of the federal government in the sense of the lack of action to produce protective clothing. Tell us about the situation that nurses and other medical workers are facing right now.
Well, in New York City, which is currently the epicenter of the virus in the United States, it's a horrifying story to tell. People are showing up to work. They have none of the personal protective equipment that they need. You know, there's cases in New York City of nurses having to wear trash bags because they don't have gowns. There's cases where people are being told to reuse the surgical mask, which, you know, defies any sort of sense of sterilization. So they're really being put in the situation of having to put healthy healthcare workers next to very sick, contagious people, and then hoping that they don't further spread that disease to everybody else. It's a nightmare scenario. This whole conversation around flattening the curve, right? Like, we expect that many people in the United States will unfortunately get the disease. But what's important is that we spread out the people who are getting it over a larger period of time, right? So that way the healthcare system isn't completely overwhelmed. You know, in New York State, there's an expectation that we'll need up to, you know, between 31,000 and 37,000 ICU beds. We have 3,000. So, you know, they're having to do all these build outs. They're having to cancel all elective surgeries. The hospitals are scrambling in order to make sure that they have enough healthcare staff and that they have enough beds available to take the influx of patients that they're all expecting. You know, Cuomo has been asking for the Army, Corps of Engineers to come out to build out new medical facilities for people to have to stay in. So for a lot of these workers on the front lines in these hospitals, they're doing a really courageous activity, but they're doing it in a very dangerous situation. And like you said, you know, the federal government has known that this has been coming for months, but, you know, Trump, the denier in chief, had his head in the sand, was claiming it wasn't that big of a deal, that it was a hoax, or that it's no worse than the flu, you know, which is totally defying what health experts were saying, totally defying what we were seeing in China and then Italy. And now we're on the same trajectory. We're seeing how the healthcare system is going to be overwhelmed. And, you know, unfortunately, it's also the case that for very many people in the United States, they're either underinsured or uninsured. So there has been, you know, already a healthcare crisis that was taking place of people who didn't receive the healthcare that they needed for the years prior, which means they have a lot of comorbidities. You know, we're a very unhealthy people in the United States. It's more than just smoking. You know, there's a lot of obesity. There's a lot of underlying health conditions that people wait to go to see a doctor until they become a health emergency because we don't have universal health care here. So I think that all of these things are compounding. You know, so the United States is in a really bad situation where we could see potentially millions of people dying from this virus. The federal government sat on its hands, and now it's healthcare workers who are taking the full brunt of it. So what they're doing, like I said, is very courageous. And it's also very unfortunate that we put them in that situation, as, you know, like you say, we as in the broader public, is because we didn't hold our government accountable, for not taking the precautions, for not making sure that the protective equipment was there or being produced, that the logistics chains weren't breaking down. There's a beginning to for some of that to be taken into account. You know, there's a talk about the big three automakers producing some of the medical equipment that's needed. That would have been great months ago. We should have been having that conversation long before now.
And yet nurses and other medical workers and their unions, if they're lucky enough to have them, are in a really difficult situation with the lack of protective gear. Because if they strike, which has been effective in other places, they could potentially endanger the lives of their patients. At the same time, if they work, they endanger their own.
You know, recently they announced the news about, you know, hospitals are looking and having do not resuscitate policies for COVID-19 patients. I mean, that's just horrifying. So if you stop breathing or your heart stops, rather than them wheeling the crash cart in and the medical staff rushing into the room to save you, they're just going to not take any action, right? And the reason being is because they don't have enough personal protective equipment to guard against everybody else, you know, in that moment, getting all of your spit, saliva, sweat and everything else on them, and therefore transmitting the disease. You know, like, those are moments when people are acting quickly and aggressively, and the disease is very likely to spread. So we're in a moment in the United States where the current system, which we've heard for how long is the greatest in the world, right, has literally led to rationing and you know, you don't want to call it death panels, but people are having to decide who lives or dies in a hospital on the basis of the availability of hospital beds and ventilators and personal protective equipment. That is a horrifying idea, and it's an indictment of the economic system that we live under. And nurses are on the front lines of this, and they're seeing it and rightfully raising questions and demands around this. Like, we need Medicare for all. We need to guarantee that everybody has access to testing in the United States. We should test. And until then, we need to socially isolate. You know, the state government should take this seriously. There should be lockdowns. There should be no discussion of returning to work. You know, we shouldn't be prioritizing Wall Street over the actual lives of human beings. So nurses, I think, you know, have come together through their unions to kind of make these broad-based demands. And in some cases, we're seeing some small grassroots actions again. You know, I was talking to a group of nurses in Chicago who didn't have any gloves or masks at all, and they were being told to go and take care of COVID patients. So they all went to the break room and demanded to speak with the hospital administration, said they weren't going to leave the break room until they came down there and found them the most basic equipment that they needed to do their job responsibly and safely, not just for themselves, but for all the other patients that they were going to see and take care of. And, you know, I mean, like, it's a small scale action, but it worked. They ended up getting the equipment. So it's like, it's from small to big. We need that level of activity. We need that level of organization happening. All of, you know, nobody's going to come and save us. We have to take up the responsibility to do this ourselves, because unfortunately, the federal government and the employers just don't have our best interests at heart.
What have we been seeing around the world in terms of labor action? Because now a third of the world's population is locked down. The pandemic is obviously global. What else has been taking place in other countries that might give us either ideas of actions to take or just be important to know in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a lot of great actions to think about, right? I mean, you know, so in Denmark, a social welfare state, if there ever was one, you know, they have guaranteed that people would receive 75% to 80% of their wages for the next few months to stay at home, right? So right now, the federal government is looking at a miserly check, you know, to write people that, you know, isn't going to be that much. But in Denmark, which is a country that's not even close to being as wealthy as the United States, they're able to guarantee that, right? So not only do they provide everybody universal health care, not only do they say that we can forego rents, you know, we can forego, you know, student debt because they don't have any, you know, they provide universal education as well. But we can also, you know, make sure that people are provided for economically in this moment in order to ease, you know, the fear that people have. So that's a great example of having correct legislative priorities that, you know, would benefit the working class as opposed to just bailing out these companies, you know, that come with hat in hand, which is really funny to say as an aside that Boeing was screaming, you know, their stock price was dropping. Nobody's flying. Nobody's buying airplanes. We need this. And so the federal government floated the idea of like, well, you know, we'll give you money in exchange for equity, which means the federal government would own shares into your company and therefore have a say in how it's run. And then Boeing said, oh, actually, we don't need the money, it turns out, right? So I think we should always take like what these companies are saying with a grain of salt. But, you know, in Italy, you know, Italy's been just decimated by this disease. It's really tragic what we see happening there. And there was still the case that many employers, especially in these large manufacturing plants that are not producing essential goods, were mandating that their workers come back to work. And there what we saw is mass scale strikes that were happening. Workers saying, hell no, we're not going in. They weren't like crowding in the streets, getting close to each other. But they were calling it a strike. They were staying home and they were being very public and articulating why it was so important and how the working class has to look out for its own best interest because these employers don't care about them. You know, so I think, you know, from small to big, we see how these actions can be, you know, like whether they're legislative or whether they're being directly done by workers can help to protect people.
So the stimulus legislation that went through Congress last week has been called, you know, historic in size. And there are provisions, some provisions anyway, for increasing unemployment insurance and also covering gig workers. But a large part of the money that is going to be spent by the federal government is to shore up corporations. How do you make sense of all the money that will be going to them rather than directly to workers in this crisis?
It's a good snapshot in time of the balance of power in the United States and how much it's slanted towards the interests of employers and not the interests of actual working people, right? I mean, there were many proposals that were put out there. I liked Bernie Sanders' proposals a lot. I thought that that would have had a greater impact overall, both on the economy and also on securing that people could stay home, which is the most important thing, right? Any economic package that we're creating shouldn't be a bailout for corporations. It should be actual relief to working people to help them get through this crisis that we're facing. And unfortunately, unfortunately, you know, the pandemic is set to last potentially for, you know, well over a month from now. So we've got to be thinking in the long term. This is just the first of several economic steps that's likely to be taken. How is this setting us up for success in the future? Unfortunately, I don't think it does. I don't think it goes far enough. I don't think it goes deep enough. And I think that, you know, it basically was a salve to Wall Street with some crumbs thrown in for working people that matter, right? Those crumbs definitely matter, but it doesn't go nearly far enough to protecting the interests of working people in this country. And I think that things are going to get worse before they get better, right? We absolutely need people to step up, to organize, to say that we could do better than this, and that the government should continue to work and operate in a way that's going to benefit all of us, not just a select few.
Chris Brooks, it seems like while it's easy to be paralyzed in a moment like this, it's frightening. You know, people are fearing for their loved ones, they're fearing for their livelihoods, but that at a time like this, we should also try and take a step back and think about the kind of not only policies that we would like to see adopted right now, but the kind of demands that we would want to make coming out of this crisis. From your perspective, what do you think would really matter?
I think that we absolutely have to have a deeper culture of solidarity. I mean, I hope that's what we come out of this, is recognizing how all of our interests are interconnected and how we can enact policies that reflect that reality, right? So universal health care for everyone, Medicare for all. That's been talked about. It's been discussed. Many people approve of it. That is a policy we absolutely need. You know, this disease is not going to go away overnight. And unfortunately, we're looking at other crises coming down the pipeline. Even if it's not the pandemic, it's climate change. You know, I'm from Tennessee, originally Nashville, right before this was hit with some terrible tornadoes. You know, so there are a lot of people out there that are suffering, a lot of people that need access to healthcare, that need good, well, you know, paying jobs, that need housing. And we can provide for those things. We are the richest nation in the country. There's no excuse for it. But what we need is the political will. So, you know, we need to organize to demand them. And I'm hoping that what we see coming out of the pandemic is a greater sense of solidarity that can help to enable that.
You just mentioned climate change. And in a way, the coronavirus pandemic has displaced the other global emergency that we face, which is the climate emergency. In fact, in ways that I'm sure none of us would want to wish on ourselves, it has actually reduced the volume of pollutants by shutting down economic activity, at least in the short term. Since these crises are simultaneous, it would make sense, as the airline industry was affected by the pandemic, to shut it down altogether, given its massive contribution to carbon emissions, while obviously supporting the workers. But rather than making these industries extinct, which really needs to happen immediately, they're being bailed out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're going through in some ways is a prelude of what's to come, unfortunately. You know, scientists have been telling us for a long time now about how horrible things are going to get, you know, and I think as long as that wasn't made real for many people, it was easy to ignore. And I think that, unfortunately, this pandemic is a great indication of that. You know, Trump said it was a hoax, he had his head in the sand, and now it's upon us. Now we see the devastation, and now we're moving into action. Unfortunately, we don't want to continue to be in the place of only reacting when things are becoming already too late. But we're beginning to also see in this moment things that could be precedent setting for the future. So I think particular Trump's use of the Defense Protection Act, where he's saying, like, you know, I could force manufacturers to have to create ventilators and respirators, this medically necessary equipment, because we have a total lack of it because the supply chain is broken down in the United States. Well, that's an important thing, right? Like, that's actually a good thing. We recognize that manufacturing in the United States is an inherently social endeavor. It's something that requires taxpayers. I mean, just think about the auto companies. Like, they've gotten bailed out by the taxpayers so many times, you know, this essential industry. Well, there's no reason why we shouldn't direct that towards things that are going to benefit us in the future. You know, what we really need is for this federal government to step in and be like, we're going to move away from fossil fuel-based automobiles, right? We need to produce the green technology of the future that's going to help to mitigate the oncoming crisis of climate change, and also begin to create jobs in the United States, you know, good-paying jobs, and begin to engage in the R&D that's necessary to build the technology of the future. You know, so I, in my opinion, you know, I follow the UAW very closely in the auto beat. And every time there's a plant closure in the United States, it should be a referendum on corporate greed. It should be a referendum on the fact that these companies continue to make tons of money, but instead of spending it on research and development of green technology, instead of investing it into the communities that they've extracted so much from, they're putting in stock buybacks so they can give bigger dividend checks to their payholders. They're giving it to Wall Street, in other words. So they're extracting all of this from our communities. They're damaging our communities, but they're not held accountable to it, and they're all benefiting from it. Well, what we need is a strong federal response to that. So, you know, there's a plant closure. Fine, we'll take over the plant. We'll reconvert it, and we'll start building, you know, electric automobiles. We'll start thinking about what it looks like to have light rail. We'll start thinking about how to build more wind turbines. You know, these are the kinds of things that we need in the United States, and we need a federal government that with a strong role in making that happen. And in order for that to happen, we need a strong labor movement.
Finally, let me ask you, how do we come together collectively since those of us who are not essential workers are shut in, necessarily keeping social distance? How do we find each other so that we can exercise the kind of collective strength we need to when we actually are able to go back into the streets?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's something that everybody's experimenting with right now. I mean, I know that in my life, like, I'm on endless video conferences right now, like all these Zoom calls that are happening. I think that, you know, part of it, like Labor Notes, is having these Zoom webinars that are open to the public where we're interviewing workers and having people join where they can listen to them talk about what their working conditions are like and how they're organizing. I think that, like, that's an opportunity. I think that people need to get really involved in organizations. Like, we have to organize, and that requires organization. So if you don't have a union at work, you need to help form a union, right? You can contact Labor Notes. You can go to our website, labornotes.org. You know, there's emails on there. You can contact us. We're happy to help connect you with union organizers across the country. You know, you need to join, you know, any sort of organization that's going to help to fight for you, you know, in your interest. And the best example of that, I think, is a union. And so I would just really encourage workers to reach out and think about how to talk to their coworkers, how to start talking to other people and start organizing on the job.
Chris, thanks so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Chris Brooks is a former union organizer, and he writes for Labor Notes. AgainstTheGrain.org has the link. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.